I am James St. James, and this is Night Fever, New York nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined by my co-host, the co-founders of World of Wonder, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. It is good to see you both.
Very good to see you. Yes, love it. Love it.
I'm so excited. Our guest today is an artist, a conservationist whose Turtle Conservancy protects turtles, tortoises, and animals on five different continents. He is a legendary club owner of places like Area and MK that we're going to talk about. He is a restaurateur. He is a hotel owner. He is a filmmaker, documentarian, producer of a little-known Netflix show called Tiger King. All this and more. Welcome to the show, Eric Good.
Wow, what an introduction, James St. James. I don't know if I'm really any of those things. I have no accolades. I got kicked out of college. I went to the school of hard knocks, but go ahead.
So many of our guests have talked about Area and talked about that particular golden age of nightlife in the 1980s. And so it's really important that we have you because we want to get your opinion and your sort of take on that whole era. You moved to New York in 1977 from California, right?
Right.
And you were going to art school. You were going to art college at Parsons.
I did.
What was Parsons like in 1977?
I did not last very long. I was spending most of my days making clothing to get into Studio 54. I shopped at Canal Rubber and Canal Plastics and Screaming Mimi's and spent all day long trying to make outrageous outfits to get into Studio 54 and then the Mud Club.
And did they open the velvet ropes for you?
I was very sneaky. I did get in.
I wonder what New York in 1977 was like as far as the art scene goes. Was there the beginning of the East Village scene? Had that started yet, or was that still a ways away?
Oh, God, we're going to sound so geriatric to think back on the old days and how great it was compared to today. But no, New York was great. For a young boy from California who didn't have money, you could live for nothing. I mean, my first apartment was $125 a month in the East Village.
Dear God in heaven.
What was happening in the late 1970s, we were getting out of bankruptcy in New York. Half the city in downtown New York was on fire, and you could get mugged really easily. And it felt like, you know, Beirut, post-apocalyptic. It was lovely. And in those days, it meant something, downtown New York. There was a downtown New York, south of 14th Street. And yeah, Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C, Avenue D, Avenue C, see you later.
You needed a tank to get to Avenue C. But at the same time, it was fabulous. I love that grunge and gritty era of New York.
It was incredible freedom, James. And it was a time when straight boys like me wanted to be gay. And, and gay boys wanted to be gay. And it was, the New York Dolls. And David Bowie, and it was a great time. And then something happened in the early 80s, but it was incredible freedom. And you could be anything you wanted to be, regardless of your size of your wallet, and live in the greatest city in the world.
I was going to say, but I think you just answered it, like, what made you move to New York if you're a California boy?
Well, that's a good question. At that time, and I kind of looked at myself, not knowing it at the time, sort of a social anthropologist, a nocturnal social anthropologist studying and looking at nightlife. And my escape as a suburban kid in Northern California was gay clubs in San Francisco in the early 1970s. That was my escape. I couldn't get into straight clubs because I was underage.
But the gays welcome you, welcome the underage again. Oh, dear.
They welcomed me, and it was fabulous. And I went to LA briefly, and I realized very quickly that the only place in the United States that you could do what I wanted to do was New York City. At that time, it was the only city in America where you could merge crazy ideas into a nightclub. And yes, it was only New York City. The only other place in the world at the time might have been Paris and London, but certainly New York was the only place in the country you could pull it off. So I went to New York City.
Now, I remember reading that while you were still in Parsons, you did a group show, and a young Keith Haring was the curator in, what, like 1978, 79? He must have just been a fetus.
No, you're talking about this drawing show at the Mug Club that Keith curated. And I want to say that was in 1980 or 81. And that show, you know, it's funny when you think back, it felt like such a small community. And that show probably had 50 artists, which, you know, the notable ones today was Jean-Michel Basquiat and, you know, Donald Batchelor and Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf. And I was in there, but they threw everyone in it along with the kitchen sink. It was just that little group of people at the time were in that drawing show. And I remember I sold my drawing because it was Etch-a-Sketches. And I actually sold them, and I told the dealer or the gallerist that bought them that, you know, Etch-a-Sketches don't last.
Right. Just shipping them probably was dangerous.
I was so proud of myself, though. I sold it. So there you go.
You went to Mud Club quite a bit, right?
I worked for Steve Mass at the Mud Club. I designed the Grecian grotto in the basement of the Mud Club, and it was terrible. It was so hideous. And Steve Mass loved it. And I painted a Tiepolo ceiling and learned how to do faux marble out of shellac. And it was hideous.
Was that you and Serge or you and Sean? Who was it?
That was Sean Hausman, who went on to design all the standard hotels around the world.
Right.
My dear high school friend, Sean Hausman, that I later collaborated with Aria.
But I have to believe that just doing an installation at the Mud Club probably was an idea that was germinating in your head that you took with you elsewhere.
Oh, my God. It was my big break, James. I was trying to get jobs at Fiorucci, and Joey Arias wouldn't hire me, and he just wanted to have sex with me. And I tried, you know, to get jobs, I don't know, at Studio 54. I think I later did get jobs at Studio 54. But I was absolutely thrilled to have a job. You know, my way of living in New York at that time was stealing, petty theft. And, you know, I hated the idea of having a 9-to-5 job.
What were you stealing? What was I need more on that.
Oh, it's a longer conversation, but I was very entrepreneurial from a very early age, and I was working on Saturday Night Fever and some films in the late 1970s, and I was given the job of location scouting. And while I location scouted around the metropolitan area, I discovered that there was something called wicker porch furniture. And I would come back at night and try to throw the wicker porch furniture in my truck and then sell it at the 26th Street flea market in New York. And it became a very successful little business. And my younger brother tried it and went to jail immediately in Pennsylvania.
We won't incriminate him anymore.
I know. It's just going to be bad. What kind of truth serum did you give me before this interview?
I'm just curious, during this time, like, were you partying? Like, what were you doing?
No, I was too desperate and poor to be really partying. That happened later in life. I do that now. But when I was younger, I was just scrambling to survive. I was not really partying. I would nurse one beer throughout the course of the night, looking at people at the Mud Club, because I didn't have enough money for a second beer. And I would get in free. So no.
I remember when I was like 16 and I would go to the Copa in Fort Lauderdale and I had my lunch money and I would have one drink that I would nurse for about 4 hours. And I am an expert to this day at nursing a cocktail.
Yeah, I would sit there with that one beer leaning against the wall, scared to death about approaching anyone because they just were too cool. And then I realized, you know, I'm too shy. I'm not as cool as, you know, all the it kids at the Mud Club in Studio 54. And so I had to open my own club because how else was I gonna, one, you know, get laid and two, do something fun?
In 1981, when I mentioned this to you before on the phone, and you, I could see you rolling your eyes saying you didn't want to talk about it, but your first club was called the Club with No Name, right? And that was, how did that come about? Describe it to me, because people talked about it in 84 when I arrived. People were still talking about it, but I don't know anything about the look of the club, how long it lasted, nothing.
Okay, so thank God there was a guy named Steven Sabin who loved me and wrote about me in Details Magazine and Soho News. He wrote a story called The Night of the Iguana about that club. And I had no money, and so I tried to open a club with no name, and I had no permits, no liquor license, no cabaret license, and I just opened an illegal club. And I trolled New York City, especially the Meat District and Lower Manhattan in the Fashion District. And I had a pickup truck, which I used also for stealing. And I decorated the whole club with the detritus that was left on the sidewalks of New York, which was fabulous back then.
I love that.
I would dumpster dive in the Meatpacking District, dumpsters with all the dead carcasses. And I would make stuff out of the bones and the meat. I remember once I scored an entire pig carcass that I hung from the ceiling. And so that club was made out of spit and tape and garbage. And then I sort of peppered in pornography, and I would go to Times Square and buy the most outrageous hardcore Super 8 porn films that I would show. In those days, it was a projector, you know, mounted on the ceiling. Anyway, the rest is history. Steven Sabin liked the club with no name, and it paved the way for me to do a real club. And remember, back in those days, after-hours clubs were everywhere, illegal clubs. There was Gay, there was Crisco Disco, there was the Flamingo, there was Berlin, there was Save the Robots, there was, you know, there was Plato's Retreat, which was legal. But the after-hours clubs, which, you know, really you would go to after a regular club. So you'd go to an after-hours club at, you know, say 2 a.m. and walk out in the sunshine and go have breakfast at Kiev or at the, you know, Empire Diner, and everyone's makeup would be dripping and their faces would be falling into their...
I remember it well, yes. Like the Continental, wasn't it? It was Arthur Weinstein's. Was that an after-hours?
So the Continental was in the same building as my club with no name. And I gave Arthur that space, but he was in the loading bay. And that's a whole other story. So Arthur did the Jefferson on, which was in the Jefferson Theater, then the Continental. And we all thought Arthur was going to get shot by the police because he brought down the 9th and 10th Precinct, you know, basically wearing a wire and busting corrupt cops. That was the time when the cops were corrupt, the mafia, of course, was corrupt, the whole city was corrupt, and it was incredible.
I remember reading a screenplay a couple of years ago about Arthur and the wiretapping and all of that. It's a fascinating story. We'll have to do a whole episode on it. Okay, so let's get to Area now, because Area was famous for reinventing itself every couple months. It had different themes, and I want to play a game with you right now. I am putting 60 seconds on the clock, and I want you to name every theme in order. Go.
I fail, but I will say night, cars, obelisk, natural history, suburbia, confinement. I'm absolutely going to fail, but I know that I did over 20 themes in the course of 3 years, 25 themes. And we always try to make the themes very different than one another. So one might be more literal, like suburbia, and the next one would be confinement or something very minimalistic or something.
I wasn't around for obelisk or confinement, and I don't quite understand what obelisk would have been.
You know, it was taken from the famous Led Zeppelin album cover where there's that object that appears in different places, this famous cover. And I always liked it, this sort of enigmatic thing that appeared in different places. And so I thought, oh, let's do something with a shape and we'll repeat it. We'll do a glass obelisk and a burning obelisk and a, you know, and it was the worst theme of all of them. It was a terrible idea.
I'm going to keep going. There was natural history, fashion, art, fairy tales, disco.
Michael Schmidt helped Way Bandy. That's when Michael Schmidt was just a child. And he was just starting out. He helped in fashion.
My first time there was for the opening of fashion, I think. And it was one of those things that changed my life. I had never seen a crowd like that. It was Andy and Liza and Bianca and Halston. It was Grace Jones. I think, maybe was that the night that Yul Brynner came? I remember seeing Yul Brynner one time. It was a mix of everybody.
Yeah, Yul Brynner was there. He gave me some advice. He said, if I had one regret, I would never have smoked. And I remember just smoking. We all smoked back then. And of course, it was illegal to smoke back then in clubs. And it was also legal to be 18 and go to a nightclub in New York when I opened the area. And then that changed to 19 and eventually 21. But yes, we did fashion and we had some, you know, wonderful people contribute. Stephen Sprouse did a great window in the entrance.
Oh, with Tommy Street was in it. The model Tommy Street was in the window. Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's right. God, you have a good memory. But yeah, we did a theme called fashion. We did one called art. And the art theme, we really tried to make fun of the artists, sort of tongue in cheek without the artists really knowing, because artists tend to take themselves very seriously. Yeah, and that included Andy Warhol and Jean-Michel Basquiat and Keith Haring and you name it. David Hockney painted our pool. And of course, when the theme was over, we just threw everything away. And I just
think, ouch, no!
Sledgehammering Keith Haring that he painted that was so beautiful. But, you know, we didn't think about money, right? We thought about, you know.
I'm just thinking back to your Etch-a-Sketch art, that like there seems to be a commitment to the throwaway, and yet going to Area, it was so spectacular. The artistry and the attention to detail was so mind-blowingly intense. I mean,
we took a page out of the early sort of very funky theme nights that the Mug Club did and Club 57 did. And then we just took it to a much higher level at that time. But when you really look back at it, Area, when you think about today and production value, it was pretty funky, but it was nowhere near as funky as the Mug Club or Club 57.
When I think about art, I remember very much the invitation for that. And it was one of those all-time amazing photos that you managed to get. Like you said, Julian Schnabel, Robert Mapplethorpe, Andy Warhol, David Hockney, Greer Langton, Keith Haring, Jean-Michel Basquiat. You had everybody in the art scene in one photo. Can you tell me a little bit about that day? Do you remember it?
Of course.
Did everyone get along?
No, they all have such huge egos. Not all, but many of them do. No, that was, I have to say, that was, I have to pat myself on the back for that one, because that was tricky. The politics of getting everyone together into that one photo. It did, you know, have kind of similarities to the surrealist photos with Duchamp and Man Ray from, you know, from the French period. I don't think there had ever been a photo that I know of in New York where all of those people came together, Francesco Clemente and Julian Schnabel, and yes, Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf and Jean-Michel Basquiat, et cetera, where you had that many people together that didn't necessarily all like one another. So it, yeah, that was a special night, and we rented out Mr. Chow's, and you know, at the time people really loved Mr. Chow's, and so maybe that's why they all came, not because of me.
Did they all get free food? Did you get free food for being in the picture?
Well, we rented out Mr. Chow's. They got the whole, yes, everything was free. Listen, I absolutely did not make money running Area, which was at the time, you know, thought to be such a incredible success story, but we poured all the money back into the themes. And we had to, you know, keep trying to outdo the one before. And so it became, you know, almost an impossible, you know, task to just keep outdoing ourselves, which eventually, of course, we couldn't do.
What is that snake that eats its own tail? What is the Ouroboros or something? That sort of sounds like what that was.
Yeah, exactly. I should know that snake since I'm a herpetologist of sorts. I should know that snake. But you know, listen, when I did Area, I never thought that the measure of success was longevity. I always thought I would approach it as you do a theater production. It has a lifespan. And when it's no longer fun, I'm going to stop. And I did. And it lasted 3 years. And it was wonderful. And it lasted, the lifespan that it had was perfect. You know, how people were able to have a club last more than 3 or 4 years, I never understood it.
Before we move on from Area, though, I do want to talk about, there were some of my favorite parties that are forever in my head, and I want to see if you have can give me any sort of backstory about them. I think one of the best parties I've ever been to ever was the Breakfast in Bed with Boy George that was at Area After Hours, and it was at Palladium simultaneously, and you ran back and forth between the two clubs. Is that, am I right about that, or was it planned that way, or did it just happen that way?
Well, you know, naughty Steve Rubell and Ian Schrager opened something called the Palladium, and they, you know, got out of prison, went to Area every night. I felt like Steve Rubell was my PR, the head of PR, because he brought everyone down to Area. Farrah Fawcett and Andy Warhol and Ryan O'Neill and everyone in the beginning, Liza Minnelli. And then he opened his own club, and he basically said, I'm going to make a bigger, better Area and monetize artists. They're the rock stars of the day, or the artists. And so,
which is what you had been doing all along.
Well, but he did the Mike Todd room with Jean-Michel Basquiat and the Keith Haring on the dance floor and the Kenny Scharf and the Fresco Clemente. And so he set a bigger, better mousetrap. And at that time, I was still trying to run Area. He had opened up the $12 million version. Area cost $200,000. And I was friends with Boy George. And Boy George said, well, I promised Steve I would do my birthday. And I said, well, Boy George, I've been better friends of you for longer. You got to do it with me. And so we basically agreed, Steve Rubell, Boy George, and I, we would split the party. The first half would be at the Palladium, and breakfast, champagne toast at 3 a.m. would be at Area. And that's what we did. And Boy George fainted. I never forgot it. He fainted at the end of the night. And I remember carrying him outside under the huge aquarium because he was exhausted. How long can you do a birthday for?
Was that the night that Marilyn was supposed to perform and did and stomped off stage?
Yeah.
That was the famous Marilyn temper tantrum.
Yes. Yes. That was the night.
Marilyn was Boy George's best friend who was trying to get a career of his own. And I remember, Fenton, that was the night that Bernard Zett and Christina Downing were both, one was Marilyn the drag queen and one was Marilyn Monroe, and they were sort of conjoined together.
Yes, we have to talk about Bernard's role too, right?
The thing about Area was that it made its own superstars, its own downtown superstars. And there was Christina Downing and Bernard Zett and Tangella, I remember, and little Michael Anderson, who was in
Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks, yes. He was, I remember he was the devil one time. He was Satan, and he was very scary. He was good. But Bernard Zett is sort of a special case. Can you talk a little bit about Bernard?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were very fortunate to attract really incredible talent in the art department and area and the performers. And Bernard Zett really had full autonomy to do what he wanted. And he would just, all he needed to know was, you know, this is confinement, you know, and he would, without any direction from us, come up with an idea, and he would perform that, whatever the subject was that he transformed himself into. You mentioned Marilyn Monroe. He would be Marilyn Monroe, you know, for 12 hours and yeah. never break out of character. And Bernard was just a, you know, like a special, special person and an incredible talent.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
And I owe people like Bernard and Christina Downing. And
I think Peter Stack was one of them.
Peter Stack, Kenny Baird.
Oh, Kenny. I love Kenny so much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kenny Baird is fabulous. So we had just a wonderful creative team. Mike Anderson, you mentioned, who later became a David Lynch character. David Yartu.
Ow!
We just had an incredible group of people that made Area what, you know, made Area Area. It was certainly not me. It was a collaboration of people that all came together that were really special and really talented.
Some of Bernard's, I can just think off the top of my head, was when he did Jane Jetson. He did Lieutenant Uhura. He did Nikki Haskell. He was Nikki Haskell. And Nikki Haskell came and sat with him and was interviewed by him. I also remember during Fairy Tales, in one of the windows was the caterpillar, who was the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, Jeffrey Strauss.
Jeffrey Stroud, right. Now, I don't know if you knew this, but Jeffrey Stroud was homeless at the time he was doing the caterpillar. And every night after work, he heard that my car was unlocked. And he would troll up and down 4th Street in his caterpillar outfit looking for my car to sleep in. And I didn't know this, but he was sleeping in my car every night. There was a snowstorm one night. I went to the car. It was covered in snow. I took the snow off and opened up the door, and there's a caterpillar in my car.
James, your car just wasn't any car also.
it was
yes. What was it? It was some kind of
it was a red Firebird with silver bucket seats.
And yes, and Jeffrey, I mean, listen, we half the art department was probably on heroin, and Jeffrey was very much on heroin, and it didn't diminish his talents, as you know, he was John Travolta for the disco theme on the dance floor, and he was a fabulous caterpillar. He was just the best caterpillar. And yes, he used that caterpillar outfit as a sleeping bag and would look for your car. I remember that.
Every morning I would go and he'd be gone, but there'd be needles and like crack pipes in my car. And I would keep thinking, I didn't smoke crack. I didn't do these needles. What is going on? And I had no idea that he'd been living in my car for about 2 months, probably.
Well, he's another incredible talent. And later was the subject of a film called American Fabulous that Reno Dakota directed. And Reno was one of our art directors at Area. And Jeffrey, again, I miss people like Jeffrey Strauss and Bernard Zett. Very different people, but both so important to the success of Area. They were fabulous.
One more party, and then we'll move on, because I think another one of my absolute favorite parties of all time is the Malcolm McLaren fans party. Do you remember that night?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I love Malcolm to the day he died. And Malcolm McLaren's fan party, I'm now conflating a Brian Ferry party where we had these women like his cover. But Malcolm McLaren's fan party, Nick Egan, Malcolm McLaren, God, I can't, you know, it's funny. We had a Fellini party that I remember more than the Malcolm McLaren party. Fellini, where everyone ate dinner on a naked woman, which makes, by the way, dinners, whether it's a naked woman or man, always better. But tell me about the Malcolm McLaren party, James, because I'm having a blank as much as I love Malcolm.
Well, all I remember from it, I have one very specific memory, is that I was on the dance floor and I turned around and I saw Linda Evans, Crystal Carrington from Dynasty, and we had the same haircut and we were both wearing Fabrice beaded dresses and we looked at each other and pointed and started dancing, and that attracted all the paparazzi because Linda had found a drag queen who looked exactly like her. And that's one of my favorite memories of Eric. Is dancing with Linda in the same outfit.
Oh my God, that is a funny story. And I do remember your blonde hair was reminiscent of Linda Evans' blow-dried blonde hair and Fabrice, those sequenced
guys. Oh, those awful, awful Fabrice that we just loved because they were so beaded and, oh, they were terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
In 1987, 88, there's a sort of a change in the air in the club scene. And that's when Nels started. I believe Nels was 88, maybe?
88, 87, yes.
Yeah. And the idea behind Nels, it was all the old people and everyone was just sort of lying on overstuffed couches, eating French fries and drinking apple teenies. And it was horrible to me. But I've got to think that you took that idea and sort of ran with it with MK. Am I correct in thinking that?
Yeah. So listen, a few things happened along the way. Of course, we don't have to go deep into them, but of course, AIDS happened right when I opened Area. And when that happened, the aftershock of that was not good. It was no longer was it, you know, cool to be, you know, have freedom and have sex and be open and, you know, be necessarily gay or bi. And so, you know, Nels was a sort of a product of suddenly, you know, there is like straight clubs, and Nels was very much that. And no longer was the mixing, you know, as acceptable for a moment. And so Nels was sort of a byproduct of that. And MK I did because, not because of what I just said, but because I just wanted to do the absolute opposite of what I had done. And so I was exhausted from changing the club every month, at Area, and I wanted some sense of permanence. And so I did MK. And yes, it was similar to Nels, and it was more of a dinner, you know, elegant, comfortable environment. I always used to say the Area was, you know, people say I'm in the hospitality business. I always say I was in the inhospitality business because Area was terribly uncomfortable. Couldn't sit anywhere and be comfortable. You were subjected to all kinds of horrific things at Area. You know, I think we filled the club had terrible air conditioning and we were always burning something. And so I decided I would do a club that was comfortable and more sophisticated. And that was MK. Nowhere near as interesting, but I did pull out the Doberman Pinschers for this interview out of deep storage. And I'm a dog lover. So please note that these dogs were put down not by me. Yes, MK was a product of sort of what was happening in the 80s and was what we did at the end of the 1980s was MK.
I want to think that some of the other contributing factors were when Warhol died, that brought about the death of downtown. Michael Musto famously wrote the article in Village Voice, and it did sort of feel like everybody who had been mingling together sort of went to their separate corners.
And actually, Andy wanted to invest in MK and be a partner in MK. And of course, he died in 1987. And then Fred Hughes, in lieu of Andy, became a partner of mine who took over, of course, after Andy died at the factory. And then very sadly, Fred Hughes got MS and he died shortly thereafter. So everyone was dying. I was going to more funerals than I ever attended in my life at that period into the early 90s. And MK was sort of a byproduct of that and opened under not the best circumstances. You know, and I was there with Jean-Michel the night he died, actually. And Keith Haring, I threw Keith's last birthday party at MK. It just felt like the end of the 80s, you know, and the rise of someone named Donald Trump and the commodification of downtown culture with Absolute Vodka and Swatch. And it just changed. And money became the currency rather than ideas. And that genius that we had before the money age of New York.
Did you make money at MK? Did that end up being a profitable thing for you?
You know, I never really made money in nightclubs. What they did for me is I could live out these fantasies, especially at Area, that were just so much fun. And frankly, what I did at Area has a lot of parallels to what I do today with even things like Tiger King and documentaries about middle America. And people always think, you know, it's, you know, you got to live in New York or LA or, but I find middle America fascinating. I think maybe I, you know, have some of the same sentiments as John Waters. I always loved, you know, that kind of culture, photographers like Bill Owens and suburban culture and the sort of the secrets that lie in the most banal places that turn out not to be banal. So, you know, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I never really made money in nightlife, but it was a vehicle to get to the next thing.
And the next thing was pivot, I think, to Bowery Bar, which was probably that, was that after or was it concurrent with MK? Because I remember going to Bowery Bar in like 93, 94. When was it?
I did go through a period where I helped my nemesis, Peter Gation, design a whole bunch of clubs.
Oh, I was just going to say, because you and Serge helped with USA, didn't you?
We built the USA. We played with Michael Alec. I put a bar in a bathroom for the first time ever, to actually have a bar in the men's and women's bathroom. We had a lot of fun with Peter Gation's dollars. And I liked Peter, even though I always felt that, you know, we had set a better mousetrap than he did. But he certainly was able to, you know, he won with the longevity contest with Limelight.
And with the monetizing, he certainly did. It's funny because when we were talking to Rudolph, Rudolph was saying that he and you and Arthur Weinstein and Frank Rocchio always went out to other clubs and always went to other parties. And you weren't just a snob staying at your own. But Peter never went anywhere other than a Peter Gation club.
That's very true. That's a very interesting observation. Yes, I went to the other places. I wanted to know what they were doing. Yes, I always wanted to know what Rudolph was doing, what Jim Farrar was doing, what Steve Rubell was doing. Before my club with no name, I did open a, or helped open a club with Steve Mass, because he saw, you know, the Mud Club fading when Area was starting to rise. And we did a little club together called Bowlmore Lanes at a bowling alley. And I, again, decorated the club with garbage and like mostly engine parts and transmissions that I painted gold. But opening night, someone killed someone else with a bowling ball. And that was it. Oh, and I just remember that there are stories in the club land that you just can't make up. And one of them was the bowling club and the bowling ball and then that death.
Someone, wait, you took a bowling ball and hit someone upside the head? What happened?
Yeah, they're dangerous, James. Be careful. But yeah. Anyway, and you know, people got shot, people died. You know, Arthur Weinstein stories. You should definitely interview Colleen, his wife, who still lives in the Chelsea Hotel. But yes, we did the Bowery Bar, and that was at a period in New York where people were starting to do hybrids, where you didn't really know if it was a club or a restaurant. And you didn't really want to eat the food because it was just too clubby and there was too much cocaine dripping off of the you know, the furniture. So yes, the Bowery Bar was a hybrid of a club and a restaurant, and lasted for 25 years.
Personally, I loved USA. I thought it was an extraordinary sort of Times Square in Times Square. And Randy and I, we were just starting World of Wonder, and we made the video stuff on the video from Michael Ealing that played.
Or the commercial that ran late night where he was in the pig outfit, right?
Yes, yeah. And I just had to ask you, like, what was your take on perception of Michael?
Michael Ealing? Oh, Michael. Oh, Michael. Oh, dear, Michael. Well, you know, it's always nice to be revered. And Michael loved me and was so tickled that Peter Gation got Eric Good to work for Peter Gation. Michael thought that was wonderful. And that was, I guess, kind of a coup at the moment. Little did they know I desperately needed the work, but at that moment in time. But Michael, you know, he worked at Area briefly as a busboy, and then, of course, began the whole sort of club kid phenomenon, or was certainly part of that whole phenomenon. I don't know. I think it's a cautionary tale, Michael, right? And all of us probably have had tendencies to go down that rabbit hole, but Michael went deeper than most. And it's a sad tale, obviously. But you have to give him credit, I guess, where credit's due. And James, you obviously were so much more a part of that than I was. I mean, I will say that the gay culture in nightlife is so important. And I was very much a heterosexual boy, man, but I didn't like hanging out with heterosexuals very much. And I recognized how important it was. And that's why when I said earlier, the only place in the country you could pull this off was New York City, not Los Angeles, not San Francisco, where you had the type of people, you know, this kind of, you know, really creative density of incredible people. And that was so clear with the people that came to Area and the people that worked there. But Michael, I don't know, James, I really can't speak to Michael other than the last time I saw Michael Ealing was at the Bowery Bar at 11 o'clock or 10 in the morning when I was having brunch with my brother and his children. And Michael pulled out, you know, he had that one pinky finger with the long fingernail with a pile of cocaine on it while I'm eating my waffles with my, you know, nephews. I was like, Michael, not now. And, you know, I don't know, 3 months later, he was in prison.
Well, I do remember you were very good to Michael during that period. I remember partying with Michael for 3 or 4 days, and then we didn't have any money for food. So we would all go to Bowery Bar, order, you know, a couple hundred dollars worth of food. And then Michael would come to you and say, we don't have any money. He would always comp us. And I think you saved us many times from starving to death. So thank you for that.
Well, I will say this about Michael. I never, ever, and maybe in my sheer stupidity, needed or used drugs as a way to, you know, attract business or as a way to promote my clubs. Never, or anything I've ever done. That was just a byproduct of the world as it is everywhere. And Michael and Peter, you know, that was a big part of the limelight and that culture and the success. And I remember Michael, you know, spending a lot of money every weekend, getting a, you know, bag full of cash and a bag full of ecstasy. And that was a big component of that culture in that time to make that happen. I never was a part of that. And I was also never a part of bottle service and never a part of this really horrible bar culture that we have today. And by the way, I'm not holier than thou. By any stretch, but I never used it as a technique to bring people into my places ever.
I got to think there's another hard pivot coming in your life when you go into the hotel business. And the was it hard to leave behind nightlife, or were you happy to move on? Because you said something like everything was leading up to that. Did it feel bad, though, a little bit? Because we missed you when you left.
Well, listen, I hung into that world far longer than I should have.
As we all did, yes.
There's nothing worse. I remember when I was in my 20s running clubs, and a 50-year-old would stroll into the club, and I would look at the man and, you know, and say, oh, my God, I'll never be that guy, 50 years old, you know, trolling for young, you know, subjects or young prey. And, of course, I've become that person. But, no, I think there's a graceful time to not do it anymore. And I think that, you know, when I think back on it, James, I can't even imagine how I did it. I can't even hear anymore. So the idea of going into a nightclub and being able to even understand what's going on is, you know, it's mind-boggling to me to think back on the endless days and nights and hours I spent in nightlife smoking, chain smoking cigarettes and drinking cosmopolitans day after day. And we, you know, we had this fear of missing out back then. If you weren't out every night, you felt like you were missing something. I'm very happy to have done it and lived through it.
Now, I can relate to so much of it. But, it's funny because when back then, Fenton and I, we were never doing drugs. Like, our experience, I mean, maybe that's why we, you know, we didn't stay out very late. We just would go out and look and loved the whole nightclub scene. But I think that's why there was always a little bit of a barrier between us and so many of the people that we were nightclub friends with, because we could never last much long. You know what I mean? We would get up in the morning and go to work. We had jobs.
I completely understand that. I was not a part of that either throughout most of my career. Area, MK, we were not druggy, and we were, you know, waking up in the morning and excited to build the next theme and think of ideas and be creative. And it wasn't for us either. You know, we were, you know, the four kids from California that didn't really fit the mold of what a nightclub proprietor is supposed to be. You know, we weren't the Arthur Weinstein, you know, or the mysterious... the mysterious German, you know, with a questionable past. We were these kind of clean cut kids from California that didn't know what we were doing, and he somehow came out of it reasonably unscathed. Never really dealt with the mafia. Never really dealt with payoffs. I interview people today know people today that were in the club world at that time, and they don't understand how I didn't, you know, have to deal with the mafia or bad cops. But I will say this, you know, what I learned through nightlife and the experiences in New York at that time actually carry on to what I do today. And it's funny, I never thought it would be useful, but it is that connectivity to people that is very helpful today. If I need to call John Waters, I can do it, or, you know, people from that time. And so it's really about bringing people together is what I did. And I still do it in hotels. And so it's not that different than what I do today. It's just not the same hours.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense, because you were sort of, so much of it was steeped in sort of creative producing and artistry. And so many people back then, and I'm sure still today, maybe in Brooklyn, but, like, you know, a lot of people went to New York to sort of create. And, you know, the clubs were often a place for those people to come together. I mean, that's why we would go to clubs. And so many people that we knew then, James, for example, were, you know, RuPaul, were all still connected. I'm curious about the beginning of the hotel career.
It was just an evolution, recognizing the ephemeral nature of nightlife. And as I said earlier, nightlife, nightclubs, it wasn't really a profitable experience for me, really. We ended up doing fine, paying back investors, walking away with some money in our pocket, but it wasn't a profitable thing. The segue from nightclubs to restaurants and then hotels was a natural evolution. And, you know, my first hotel was the Maritime Hotel, and it was somewhat opportunistic. It wasn't that I was plotting or dreaming about being a hotelier, owning hotels, but an opportunity arose and I took advantage of it. And one hotel led to the other. And then at a certain point, I felt that that was repetitive. And, you know, what am I going to do? You know, empire build for the rest of my life. And so I did a number of hotels, and I'm very blessed to have them. And they've made it very easy for me to do the things I do today, because those businesses were much more sound than a nightclub. And so the hotel world has been very good to me. And I'm opening a little hotel here in Ojai, California, a 100-year-old hotel in the next year or two. But I've always, you know, been interested in trying different things. And I tend to, you know, you can call me a dilettante, but I tend to get bored once I've kind of cracked the code of something and figured it out. And then I want to move on to something else. And that for me now, as you guys know, is you know, trying to do what you guys have mastered. I accidentally was successful with Tiger King, and I, you know, as they say, you're as good as your last picture. We'll see if I'm any good beyond Tiger King. But now I'm working on other documentaries.
Stop right there. Because one, the Maritime is the only hotel I will ever stay in New York. I've been there since even before it opened, and it's the only place I will go. Number one. So you open your first hotel, and it's just genius. That's one. Then you do your first film series, not just a single film series, and it's spectacular. I mean, what the fuck? You say, oh, trying to do what we're trying to do. No. You are a master, and you just, like, lay a golden egg here, potter over here, lay another golden egg. Oh, I'll do a hotel.
Golden. I mean, it's a spectacular story.
You're very kind, but I think back at a hotel that I bought, you know, called the Jane Hotel, where, you know, where RuPaul used to live, when RuPaul had nothing on the piers. And I just think about what you've done with RuPaul and, you know, just what you guys have done as a company, World of Wonder. And I remember your beginnings, both of you. I didn't know you well, but it's phenomenal. So I, you know, just applaud what you guys have done in Hollywood.
We could blow smoke up each other, but I do want to tell you one story very, very quickly. When World of Wonder was starting out, Randy, we were still living on 9th Street, I think. And I came down to Area. I had a meeting with you, and I pitched you an idea for Area installation that was called World of Wonder. It was going to be all that sort of World Fair shit, that sort of holistic.
Oh, right.
And you were very polite. And also, no, I don't think we're going to do that.
You know, Fenton, I remember that, but it was, I remember that actually meeting you. I remember meeting you, and I remember that's when we were basically gasping on fumes, and the club was sort of, you know, on its way, you know, down. But I do remember meeting you then, absolutely.
Because I went away thinking, how dare I even, like, what was I, thought I was on crack or something.
And then when I sent in, like, audacious, like, I'll go to someone else's club, pitch them a theme based on, like.
I blush. It's one of those, it's a story I've never dared to tell. Because I'll just think about it, and then I'll just go bright red and hope no one's in the room as I remember it.
Well, listen, you guys, I'm just very impressed with James's indelible memory that you remember all these things. And I'm a bit embarrassed that I can't think of a anecdote about that party with Malcolm McLaren. So I was, before this interview today, I was thinking, God, will I remember anything? Because it does seem like a few lifetimes ago, days running Area and New York City in the early 1980s and mid 80s. It does feel like a long time ago.
Well, but the thing about this show that I notice time and time again is that everybody says, I don't remember anything. It was 40 years ago. But then once you get talking, you do get stories and you do get insight and everything. So thank you so much for doing this. I do want to ask one before we go, though. Was there a transformative moment in your childhood that involved a turtle? Were you a turtle in a former life? Where did the turtle obsession come from?
Oh, dear. I think I suffer from latent adolescence, James, and it's probably why I never grew up. And, I still don't think of myself as a real adult, but my parents made the mistake of giving me a pet tortoise when I was 6 years old. And I was a introverted child that spent a lot of time alone. And I just doted on my pet tortoise. I would take my tortoise on the plane flying from New York to California. The attendants would give my tortoise salad and I would have it on my little tray. And I just remember, going back and forth from both sides of the country with my little tortoise. And when I first made some money, I was interviewed by Andy Warhol for Andy Warhol TV. And in typical Andy fashion, "Gee, Eric, what are you going to do with all your money?" And I said, "I'm going to buy tortoises." And that's what I did. And so in 1984, when I started making money at Area, I started cohabitating with tortoises in my loft in New York City. And my sister said it was like living with goats because they were big and they were not the particularly clean, put it that way. But anyway, the obsession has always been there. And I've been a person that just gets obsessed with things. And I think that's a big key to my success. Once I say I'm going to do something, I am like a dog with a bone, for better or worse. And tortoises have been the bone for 60 years.
Well, God bless you for the work that you do with Animal Conservancy and especially the turtles and tortoises. Thank you again for being on the show. I'm so glad we did this.
Just the best. Thank you.
Yeah, a lot of fun, you guys. Thank you.